Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. David Crowley ends his bid for governor, instead endorsing Sarah Rodriguez. And the TV ad wars heat up. Plus, Vice President J.D. Vance visits Milwaukee. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for July 10th.
I'm Ani Van Wagtenthonk.
I'm J.R. Ross.
Welcome to Rewind. And then there were five. This is kind of the big update for the week, is that David Crowley ended his campaign this week, whittling down the crowded primary field for governor to slightly less crowded. Joel Brennan, Kelder Royce, Fran Hong, Sarah Rodriguez, and Mandela Barnes are all left. David Crowley dropped out, did not immediately endorse anyone, but then the next day came out and threw his weight behind Sarah Rodriguez.
So I know there's like this kind of grand conspiracy theory of like there's these powers that be that in a smoke-filled room will like pull, say, you can run and you can't run. It's not really what happens a lot of times. Granted, you will see the national level, for example, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee endorsing a primary or, you know, national group. That's a little bit different story. What's happening here is a simple equation. Campaigns ask themselves two questions most of the time they're going through this process. Do I have a path to victory and do I have the money to pull it off? And when the answer becomes no, what's the point of running anymore? For both Missy Hughes and David Crowley, the answer became no. That's what basically happened here. Crowley, during his news conference endorsing Rodriguez, said, look, nobody called me. Nobody said you should get out. Is in the establishment trying to push me out of this race because of Francesca Hong or whatever. It's me saying, I don't have a path to get there. This person does. So my question becomes, one, will anybody else get out? We'll see in the coming next week, we'll see finance reports. That'll give us an idea of like where the field is financially. If people do get out, will that help Sarah? Because there's this perception that Francesca Hahn may have a cap. What it is, I don't know, but that there's only a certain say in the base that is open to a Democrat socialist. And Mandela Barnes, for all this great name ID that he has, even on polling shows him at 30%. He's not getting 50. So what is the cap for those two, and can Sarah consolidate this, let's call it the non-Francesca, non-Mandela Barnes vote, or will Kelder Royce pull votes away? Will Joel Brennan stay in? You know, what's that dynamic look like in the coming weeks?
And, you know, we're going to talk about ads and sort of money, the money question in just a moment, but I think that really is a big piece of the picture, and there's so much, speaking of smoky rooms, like so much rumor right now just around like who has money, who's viable, and so I think that's part of what we're going to be seeing is some of that just like financial signaling to try to show who is viable. I was speaking with a Republican strategist this week who was saying that one of the kind of interesting things about this is that money kind of functions differently in the different campaigns. So he said, you know, Francesca Hung, for example, is running a campaign that is based a little bit less around having a ton of TV time, so she doesn't need money in quite the same way that some of the other candidates do. But let's get into those ad wars that are really kind of starting to launch. So Sarah Rodriguez announced kind of the biggest ad buy so far of the race, $1 million ad buy, and that's significant not just for the number itself, but also that it's coming from her campaign, not an affiliated PAC. Mandela Barnes announced a six-figure ad buy. A group backing him is launching ads. And then on the other side of things, while they're all kind of still trying to stand out as individuals, Tom Tiffany is out putting out an ad about having pancake breakfast and a much more just sort of like get to know this nice guy up north. What are you taking away from some of these ads that are coming up?
Let's talk about Tiffany first. So he has basically been unanswered so far in the airwaves to have this kind of chance to define himself as this folksy, down-earth guy. Democrats want to define him as a pro-Trump MAGA extremist who's anti-abortion and all these, you know, bad things for swing voters. But Tiffany, for so far, has been able to say, hey, you know, I'm going to audit state government, going to stop Wall Street buying your homes, I'm going to kind of fix things, make things more affordable. We are just now seeing the Democratic Governors Association weigh in. There's a new group they formed that is now doing ads to try and finally answer to Tiffany, because the Democrats all focus on each other. They can't really worry about Tom Tiffany right now. They're worried about each other. Granted, you're seeing like the occasional, you know, I'm going to stop Trump and Tiffany in the ads. But for the most part, he's unanswered. So now we got that going on. In the primary itself, interesting that one, Rodriguez was touting last fall that she had 4 million in support for this campaign. Okay, so we've seen $900,000 from an outside group so far. Where's the rest? Now, we are weeks away from the primary, so you could, in theory, like drop a whole ton of money in the final weeks, but it's getting kind of late, so I keep hearing rumors of, oh, it's coming. Okay, when? Two, interesting with the Barnes that, again, with the money question, so he's like, I'm doing a six-figure TV buy focused on Milwaukee. He announced that the day after, I think, the group backing him says, we're doing a $500,000 TV buy in Madison. So very convenient that the group backing him is focused on Madison TV, and he's taking care of Milwaukee, the two biggest pots of Democratic primary voters in Wisconsin. Okay, interesting. Now, Kelda Royce, she's been talking about a $500,000 buy, but it's on streaming and digital. We don't really track that very well in general. At Impact, we subscribe to that with politics. Really can't track those two services very well, so she says she's doing that much money. Okay, maybe. She says she raised $1.2 million in the period. Okay, I don't know how she raised it yet. I asked her campaign questions after she put this release saying, I raised $1.2 million. She talked about the number of donations and an average of less than $150. I'm pretty decent at math for a journalist. I multiplied the number of donations by 150 and got $400,000. So where did the rest come from, right? She said no personal money can win in there. Okay, great. We'll see on Wednesday the details. But we're not seeing the massive like dump of money just yet. So I'm wondering is it coming late? And will Wednesday really set the scene of, okay, this is what they have to spend? For Barnes is a big thing here. He's this guy who has a national fundraising list from running for U.S. Senate. He had a disappointing report in January because he got in December, which was late, but he's supposed to have like this giant list of just money to pour in, didn't. Does he have a great report in July that shows all this money to go spend? Maybe. Where's Rodriguez at? She says $1 million buy. Okay, does she have more than $1 million in the bank? And a job. Just fascinated by that. And meanwhile, Tom Tiffany's just spending money all on his own, and he's not even answered very much.
Yeah, I mean, I think you point to sort of a slightly crazy thing about our election system, which is that we are about to see essentially the first financial reports of these elections, not because there weren't earlier ones in January, but because these are the ones that really matter. But we're less than 4 weeks out from the primary, and then the primary is just a few weeks out from the general election. And so it's almost as though Tom Tiffany's been running a race this entire time, and these Democrats have these very kind of fractured opportunities. And then I think we will see an enormous dumping of national money in 4 weeks, and then what does that do? So it's very mysterious. This is like what I keep hearing from people on the campaigns is like, we don't really know what's going on either, you know?
In rapid succession. July 15th fundraising reports, July 22nd Marquette poll, July 28th WISN debate, August 11th primary. So it's going to come together quickly from here on out.
Yeah. Well, so that partly explains why Vice President J.D. Vance was in Milwaukee this week, why he is paying attention to us in this midterm year. He was there, I would say, to campaign for Derek Van Orden, to just kind of make sure that people who are supportive of Tom Tiffany and Donald Trump, are getting excited, but also to kind of hammer a bit of a message around fraud. So let's take a look at some video from his visit.
I cannot tell you whether the state of Wisconsin has illegal aliens who are ineligible, who are receiving food stamp benefits paid for by your tax dollars. And the reason why I don't know the answer is because the governor of this state will not give us the data that allows us to say, well, this person is eligible, this person is an illegal alien, scratch them off the list. So I'll say to the governor of this state, even though he's not of my political party, the attorney general, anybody else, you have an open offer to come into the White House and to talk about how we can combat fraud together. I will work with you. I will make it easier. I will give you federal resources. I will do whatever I need to do. But it's got to be a two-way street. If you're hiding the food stamp rolls because you don't want to tell us whether illegal aliens are getting food stamp, that's not cooperation. That is you hiding criminal conduct from the American people, and it's a scandal, and it absolutely has to stop.
So I think this is really interesting in this election year that the White House, the Trump administration, is kind of hammering on this idea of we're going to root out corruption and fraud, that they are making that sort of an election year issue. And before we discuss it, I should say, you know, when he's blaming Tony Evers for not releasing the SNAP data, I couldn't find video of Tony Evers talking about this. But, for example, when he vetoed the bill that would have released this information, he essentially said, I object to sharing Wisconsinites' most sensitive personal data, including Social Security numbers, et cetera, because I don't think that it can be appropriately secured, will not be able to be accessed by broad swaths of federal employees, and I can't trust that it will not be shared inappropriately both within and outside of the federal government. So he has made clear that he thinks essentially no fraud is taking place. You can point to, you know, the SNAP error rate in Wisconsin, which is one of the lowest in the country, is also separate from a fraud measurement. But it's interesting that this is kind of the message that the White House is trying to hammer against Democratic governors, against this Democratic governor, is this idea of not being able to trust them.
Yeah, normal versus crazy. That's kind of like their line from the White House. Also interesting, this is coming as we've had this fight between the federal government and the state over SNAP rolls, over voter election rolls, all these kinds of things. And we have seen, you mentioned Van Orden, whose district is not in Milwaukee, by the way. It's a couple hundred miles away. He has now seen visits from, I think, Howard Lutnick, I think at least four or five cabinet secretaries in the last 3 months, along with the vice president being in Plover back in February, the president being in Chippewa Falls, which might be right on the edge of his district, can't remember for sure. But there's definitely an effort here to try to pump up Van Orden, who's the most vulnerable member of the congressional delegation for Republicans in Wisconsin.
Well, and at the same time that while we're talking about, you know, Democrats in the governor's race kind of figuring out who's going to emerge, there's also a pretty competitive primary in his district. And so once again, we see like a standalone Republican and then Democrats trying to figure out sort of where they're at. And so it's a really... It continues to be a very interesting election cycle. This is also a big week in the Wisconsin Supreme Court. A number of decisions this morning. The kind of latest in the lame duck lawsuits was resolved in Josh Call's favor. That's why he is smiling so broadly there on the screen. Essentially, the liberal majority on the court said that the DOJ, the AG's office, can control where multi-state settlement money goes. The question was, it has to go into the general fund. Can it then go into a fund that is at the discretion of the attorney general? And the liberal majority said yes. Conservative minority said this is yet again the liberal majority handing a victory to specifically Democratic Attorney General Josh Call rather than the AG's office as a whole. And then they didn't rule on the second question about sort of more granularly where the settlement money exactly can or can't go. What do you make of that kind of split decision?
So basically, the Supreme Court punted, and it leaves a lot of questions unanswered that will produce more lawsuits going forward. So it's kind of a convoluted decision, but first you have this one part of state law about whether they can deposit these money into accounts that are part of the general fund, but they're under the DOJ's purview. And justices said, yes, that's right. But the second question, which is really interesting, the court actually raised this issue on its own. It wasn't part of the appeal. The court said, we want you to answer this question. Does this law impact this? And the liberal majority said, you know what? We're so split, we're just going to say, nah, we can't address that. Brian Hagedorn says, yes, I agree. This one law you talk about, that's correct about what can happen. But we really dropped the ball here not addressing the second law. It's really inappropriate. And if you look at Rebecca Bradley's dissent, there's some kind of hinting what happened here. What she's saying is, you guys dropped the second question because you know if you read the law, two laws together, Call can't put this money in these funds. It has to go in the general fund. You dropped it to produce a politically popular or politically favorable opinion for him ahead of his reelection campaign, and you did it in a very expedient way, which really kind of turked me off. So if I'd had my chance, here's my majority opinion. That would have been basically 7-0, that he can't do this. What she's hinting at here is a little bit of, we basically agreed this wasn't cool, and you guys changed the rules. Now, again, we can't say that for sure because they don't like allow us into the discussion room, but that's what Bradley's kind of hinting at here, of you guys ignored this second law to give a win for Call. And oh, by the way, her opinion has this whole list of cases in which you've ruled for the Democrats and not for Republicans. I think something's going to follow here. So for what it's worth, that's one person's opinion from Rebecca Bradley what would happen here.
You know, and I can't say for sure, but I think it is the first dissent I have read in Wisconsin Supreme Court history that mentions the movie Dodgeball. but, you know, when we talk about, like, why does this kind of thing matter, it really is a separation of powers question, and it's just the latest of, you know, this back and forth about executive versus legislative at a time that we have a Democratic executive branch and a Republican-controlled legislature. All of that could very well change in November, and so it'll be really interesting to see how all of these very recent decisions under this new liberal majority sort of could play out if things do change in November.
And this issue between call and legislature, it will not be resolved unless there's a trifecta either way, and they go back and overhaul the laws. If Republicans, you go, like, tighten them up, or if you're Democrats, you do away with all of it.
There were also there was another decision in this question. Conservative activists coming out of 2020 wanted access to guardianship records. Essentially, they alleged that people who were ineligible to vote have been voting, and the court rules that it's very clear in state law that those records cannot be accessed. So that's a sort of interesting, again, this kind of tale of 2020. We're continuing to see that kind of litigated. And we're going to talk a little bit about some issues with election administration in the state in a little bit. And then the other kind of big order this week was a stay was issued in this case that's challenging ICE detainers, essentially, while it's going through federal court.
So the five sheriffs who were sued try to move the case to federal court. A U.S. District Judge in May said, no, you waited too long to ask, make this request. It's going back to the state courts. The Supreme Court began, like, moving forward again on it. The sheriff said, hey, wait a second. We're appealing to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago. We want you to put things back on hold, issue a stay in this case, because that's not a good thing to have this pending out there. It'd be a waste of effort on your part, Supreme Court of Wisconsin, if they take it in the feds. The ACLU, representing Voces de la Frontera, said, no, don't put this on hold. There are all these issues that the longer you wait, the more people are putting on these detainers. We need to go forward. The court said, yeah, we're going to put everything on hold for now and wait until we have the federal court first.
So in the meantime, those detainers do continue. It's just that the state court case has paused. Sort of related to all of this, Hannah Dugan received her sentence this week. So this is, of course, the former Milwaukee judge who let a person out of her courtroom who's there for being pursued, I guess, by immigration agents. And she has since, she was found guilty of a felony. She has left being a judge. And so she was convicted to a $5,000 fine, no jail time. The judge in this case, Lynn Edelman, said, this is a case of a good person upset by immigration enforcement in this country, a sentiment widely shared, making a bad decision in the moment. And she also made a statement saying, I'm neither a hero nor a scofflaw. I was sort of just doing what I thought was right for the decorum of my court. What do you make of that decision?
One, Edelman's a former Democrat lawmaker, kind of the most liberal member of the court in the Eastern District. So there was a perception going in he wasn't going to drop the hammer on Hannah Dugan. Plus, the robes take care of their own, I guess you could say, in a way. They're not going to really punish a judge that harshly. She says she's going to appeal the conviction. I've had some people argue to me, like, hey, just let it go. Like, it's a $5,000 fine. Just make it go away. Of course, I'm not a convicted felon. I don't know what it's like to have that on my record. Just let sleeping dogs lie, because if you appeal and things like get thrown out, what have you go back to trial? And it's not Ailey anymore in charge of the case, but somebody else, and they bring the hammer on you down the road. So an interesting thing to watch going forward, what the outcome's going to be, if that appeal leads to a new trial or it being thrown out, or could she face a stiffer penalty down the road if she does win the appeal but loses a retrial?
Right. I mean, prosecutors obviously asked for quite a bit of jail time. The kind of sentencing guidelines pointed to a little bit of jail time. And so I think there was this question of, like, sort of to what extent will she be made an example of? And I think one of the things that came up during the sentencing proceedings was, well, she's been made an example of in a certain way, in that no judge is going to want the Hannah Dugan treatment. Judge Edelman talked about, you know, she's developed depression. Like, this is, her family's been threatened. She's been threatened. So this has been a really challenging experience, sort of regardless of whether there's jail time at the end of it. So there is, I think, something to pay attention to in terms of how other judges kind of facing things like this. This is not the first case like this in America. It may not be the last, but kind of how this plays out there. I mentioned troubles in election administration. So we talked last week about this clerk in Green Bay who, for the second time in pretty recent months, sent out duplicate absentee ballots. WEC had a meeting this week to recommend what to do. And so we will take a look at some video of their discussion of that.
If a municipality is using the WISVOTE system to print the stickers that go on the outgoing envelopes to voters containing their ballots, if you use that system, you cannot do a duplicate generation of those stickers. You can't do it. We put in a fail-safe, and that fail-safe is there specifically to prevent this from happening. And I want everyone to know that that system works and has worked and does work. Where this has happened more than once is where communities have elected to not use the WISVOTE system to generate their own stickers.
Part of my concern is if there is a reason to use something other than WISVOTE to generate labels, and you know, I talk to clerks and they sometimes have given me reasons why they would use something else. But if you're going to use something else, this something else, this other program, software, platform, whatever, should have the same sort of safeguards. And so I think it may come to a point where in the future, if clerks are going to use some sort of either Adobe program or something, that it has to meet certain requirements. And I think that could be a role that in the future, probably not before the fall election, but in the future, the commission is going to have to take a position on it.
So you were teasing me on my notes. I wrote stickers because, you know, it really a lot of these arguments kind of boil down to these very granular details about these systems and processes. And so, you know, that was maybe not the most like sexy tape we've ever shown on this show, but I think it really kind of points to all of these things are in place to try to avoid duplicate absentee ballots going out, which raises all this kind of like suspicion and concern from people who don't entirely trust these institutions, and kind of reflecting that this clerk was put on leave after that WEC recommendation. They said that pending the completion of the city's ongoing internal review and investigation, that she'll be on leave throughout that process.
Look, Wisconsin elections, for the most part, secure, accurate. There are problems at times, mostly administrative human error. But when you have human errors like duplicate ballots and back-to-back elections, like the Madison clerk not counting ballots because they just lost track of them from November 24, like Madison clerk failing to deliver ballots to the polling place on time, it creates a perception, an opening for those who believe the elections are rigged to say, aha, there's something amiss. The more problems you have, the more fodder you have for those folks. Here, Green Bay's been the eye of the storm for a while when it comes to elections. They're part of the whole thing in 2020 with the Center for Tech and Civic Life grants, I believe it was, a group formed by Mark Zuckerberg. Lots of communities took the money in 2020 because they're running an election during a pandemic. Five big Democratic cities took the most money. There are people who believe that that helped Joe Biden quite a bit in Wisconsin. Okay. The more problems you have in Green Bay, the more you create the opportunity for these folks to say, if things don't go their way in November, aha, it was fraud. It was these guys are acting inappropriately and doing things. By taking this step, Green Bay, we got to watch, one, does Celestine Jeffries come back to her job? Is this it? She done, or is she going to get a suspension? And then two, who takes over, or does she come back, and how do they administer things going forward? Because again, in April, when this issue popped up, she basically blamed a snowstorm. We had printed the labels already. We were shut down for a day because of a snowstorm. Somebody came in, thought they weren't done yet, created duplicates and sent them out. Okay. She also made the argument in her response to the complaint filed against her that it's not illegal to send duplicate ballots to voters, which is really kind of a unique case to make. This one, they said, oh, it's an administrative error. Okay, well, what was the error? We still don't know from the city, like, what happened. They just has a printing issue. Okay, well, what was it? And when you don't answer questions, you again create opportunities to raise concerns and to throw barbs at people if, hey, you're not doing something correctly. So I'm watching now. What's the city's answer? How they make sure that these people, however many there were, they got to be about only cast one. Who's in charge in October, November, when there's really a big election coming up? Those are going to be big questions to be answered, and that could shape the perception of how well this election was run in Wisconsin.
And before the show, we were talking about how Wisconsin has this very decentralized system. And so when Ann Jacobs is talking about, look, we have like a a sticker process or whatever, these clerks don't necessarily have to follow those things. They can kind of develop their own procedures. And in some ways that makes sense, right? Because like a clerk could be overseeing a village of 400 people, or it could be the city of Green Bay, and maybe you need really different processes for that. But I think it does, you know, it does not help with that perception when you also have very different processes in every corner of the state.
Don Mills said something during the meeting of, look, at some point we have to say, you have to meet, if you're not going to use the sticker system, you may have to have meet X, Y, and Z to do what you're doing, because we can't do this anymore.
Also this week, we have the latest will lawsuit. This was something that was sort of signaled after this recent decision around scholarships that are aimed at certain minority students, and they essentially came out and said, we will now be using this as a precedent to go after other kind of diversity initiatives. And so this one is going after Wisconsin Supplier Diversity Program, which is run by the DOA, and it essentially just aims to give a certain number of contracts to minority-owned businesses, service-disabled veteran-owned businesses, and women-owned businesses. And this is part of Will's sort of broader agenda of going after these as kind of illegally race-based programs. They say that they have gone after or represented over 80 clients from 26 states, and this is kind of the latest one in Wisconsin.
And more are going to come. Dan Lenington's an attorney with Will. After the ruling earlier this year that the Supreme Court of Wisconsin said, yes, you cannot do this scholarship program anymore, he put out like a list of like eight different things that, in his eyes, state government are not good anymore. That could be a challenge view that said, hey, if you want to help us challenge this stuff, come right up. Now we have these taxpayers challenging this law. It'd be interesting to see how you can justify doing a race-based program like this in light of that precedent from the Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court about how race can be used in this country anymore.
I'm also interested, you know, like having, for example, like the veteran grants mixed in with race-based or gender-based things. I've also spoken with some who in the higher education space who've said, you know, like they had programs that were aimed at minority students that were also included things for just lower-income students more broadly. So will they be kind of pulling these kinds of programs out in order to comply with this Supreme Court decision, the U.S. Supreme Court decision around race-based programming? Like, how will they be either preemptively trying to comply, or will there just be many, many more will lawsuits to come? We will end the show on a fairly sad note, which is that former Senator, State Senator Paul Farrow, the Waukesha County executive, died of cancer this week. I never covered him while he was in the legislature, but I understand that you knew him fairly well.
Oh, he's in the family business. His mother, Margaret Farrow, served in the state Senate, first female lieutenant governor. He won a seat in the assembly in 2010, then went to the Senate like his mother had after that, then ran for county executive. Just a different kind of public figure versus what we have today. Not there's anything wrong with people we have today, but there was a time where you could argue and disagree, but you could still be personable and get along. Paul comes from that like long line of people who remember a different time in Wisconsin when it was okay to disagree and not, you don't have to dislike each other when you do it. And he, I mean, praised by everybody. I don't think anybody said a bad word about him after he passed away. You can tell both Brian Schimming talking about how he inspired conservatives going forward, and Governor Evers talking about a great guy he was. That's a sign of what an imprint you left in people.
Well, yeah, certainly sending our condolences to his family and everyone who cared about him. And that will do it for us on Rewind. I am Anjuvan Wagtendahl.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
See you next week.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrell Studio.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.